This is the Blockchain Billions Podcast with your host, Henrik de Geer.
I'm Henrik de Geer. Today I'm speaking with Michael Minnelli. Michael, how are you?
I'm fine. Good day, Henrik. Michael Minnelli here from Zien in London.
Michael, who are you and what do you do?
Here at Zien in London, we are a firm that has typically been on the border of research in finance and research in technology, and we've been doing that for over 22 years. We were founded initially to be wherever finance and technology meant, typically with some type of social purpose behind it. We're a small team here in London, about 25 people, and I've been leading this group for nearly a quarter century, looking at a whole variety of things from pure finance to pure technology. We got involved in blockchain back in 1995. That'll probably stun a few of your readers, but it's a fairly old technique in terms of creating a static data structure that's very difficult to change. And I think a lot of the recent furore, interest, hype on cryptocurrencies certainly has done us a lot of good because people are beginning to take a look at some of the work that we did a couple of decades ago and seeing how it might apply today.
Michael, how were you involved with blockchain?
Well, as I alluded to, our first foray into distributed ledgers began back in 1995. And I use the term mutual distributed ledgers in preference to blockchain for a few reasons. The first reason is that the term blockchain is quite recent. It dates, as much as I've been able to find out, to about April 2012. In fact, it comes quite significantly after the introduction of Bitcoin in late 2008 and going live in January 2009. So it took a few years for that term to arrive. And I think mutual distributed ledgers does a better job of explaining what we're looking at. So I'll just tease apart those three words, a ledger. But in this case, a ledger that is immutable or unchangeable, permanent, tamper-proof. Distributed, in that it's across many machines. Anybody who wants a copy can have one. And because there are many copies of the database, and because nobody owns the database, it's mutual in the sense that either everybody holds it in common, or if you want to look at it in a slightly different way, nobody owns it at all. And this has, I think, some very important implications for the adoption of the technology. As a database, which is really what these are, we've moved from single user databases to multiple user databases in the late 70s and 80s. And now what we're looking at is the advent of a multi-organizational database that nobody owns. And this allows us to work in new ways together. Strictly speaking, as a database, these aren't particularly good. If you look at the old database paradigm, I wanted parsimony and efficiency. I wanted high speed. These are not particularly speedy. They're not particularly parsimonious because you're storing everything for as long as you possibly can. But they are a reflection of the change in economics from the 1960s and 70s to the modern era. And those changes are principally that the cost of storage and computing power has gone through the floor. And the cost of connectivity is also cheap, but connectivity is now pretty much ubiquitous. So the potential for these ledgers is across everything, including sort of the entire Internet of Things.
Michael, what are the biggest challenges and successes with blockchain?
Well, our biggest successes in mutual distributed ledgers have been in helping people to share the recording of permanent data. And because they're sharing this recording of permanent data, it's changing their trust structures. That sounds a bit abstract, so I'll try and give it some meat. Let me give you one application that we're doing, which is we provide for clinical trials organizations or clinical research organizations, CROs as they are, a facility for them to write out on the day, well, at the moment that they do an intervention or trial, what happened. But why is this important? Well, they've now got a time-stamped data log of every single intervention that they've done in a medical treatment. So if I have you coming into my doctor's surgery or facility and I give you a treatment, I've recorded very clearly that I gave you the treatment on this day and what I gave you. And why is that crucial? Well, it's because 5 or 6 years from now, when the clinical trial goes forward for approval as a treatment or a drug, I'm able to show that I did not delete any data, I did not alter any data, and all the people that I thought were in the trial stayed in the trial. I didn't magically lose some inconvenient cases that were making my trial or my treatment or my drug look bad. So this is, I think, is just one interesting application. Another area that we've had success in has been in time stamping for governments. So the Channel Islands use a distributed time stamping ledger that we built, Metronomo. And Metronomo is used to take documents that are there for official government purposes and place them onto a permanent, semi-transparent record. So it's just moving into the digital age, the various notarizing, document sealing, document stamping, approval services that many governments have had. The Channel Islands have moved this way. Dubai is not using our services, but has announced that it too is looking to put all government relationships, timestamps, if you will, on a ledger by 2020. A third area where we've been quite successful has been in the insurance sector. It's quite interesting for me. People tend to focus on banking, principally, I suspect, because they've discovered distributed ledgers or blockchains through the cryptocurrencies. So a lot of the hype is about new types of payment systems. But as the previous two examples showed, there's a tremendous amount of data sharing that these facilitate, because I'm able to share data with you and you don't get control of it. I'll come back to that in a minute, if I may. So what are insurers doing? Well, a typical client, broker, and underwriting situation is a mess of messaging. The client asks my broker sends it to the underwriter sends it back to the broker. Things get lost, the client asks for evidence, the broker may or may not pass on all of it. And so what you do with this is you have a centrally, logically it's a central database that everybody's sharing and nobody owns. But in reality, people have got their own copies of the database at the same time. And this allows them to see much more transparently what is on risk, what is off risk, what's being quoted. The client sees what's been insured. The underwriter sees what they've taken on risk. And in between, the broker is managing the situation far better, because they're not sitting there as a poor messenger or carrier boy in the center. For me, the big transformation on these ledgers is not particularly a technological one. It's an economic and social one. And the reason is that these ledgers provide an ability to transform the way that we handle central third parties in society. If you go back to some of our very oldest records of ledgers, those would be the Sumerians back some 6.5 millennia ago. They were recording on cuneiform tablets a whole bunch of obligations that people had to one another. You know, Heth owes Ham a couple bushels of wheat, Ham owes Sept a couple of barrels of beer. The Sumerians, for me as an accountant, are an exciting and thrilling people, because instead of spending too much time on great legends, although they did write the Epic of Gilgamesh, nevertheless, what they've succeeded in doing is leaving us a wealth of accounting records. And we see that transformation in technology through the advent of papyri, through tally sticks in the Middle Ages, which were these sticks of boxwood or ash that would be split and handed to people. We've seen it through the advent of paper ledgers, the sort of Dickensian ledgers on the high stools with the quill pen. And then we had databases starting really in the 1960s and 70s. And this is just a part of that progression. But what makes them powerful is that the ledger that's holding on to all the sorts of records, and if you look at society as a bunch of ledgers in a somewhat monocular way, you will see ledgers everywhere. Your school records are on a ledger that the school holds, your tax records, your driver's license, your bank ledgers. Everything is a ledger, a recording of an entry that somebody has about you or that you have about them. Now, the way that we've traditionally handled these things has been to set up a central third party. So we have a central third party who sits in between you and me and handles those transactions. You might say a bank, you might say an insurance broker, what have you. Because these ledgers are unowned, for the first time, we are reducing the power of that central third party. So the central third party is not as able as they were in the past to exploit what becomes a natural monopoly. And so if you think about exchanges, central securities depositories, CCPs, and I'm just going through all the areas in financial services, mm-hmm. your credit card providers, etc., what you're seeing is that this technology moves two elements of a central third party into the ledger. The actual ledger itself moves into the technology, and the safeguarding of the records moves into the technology. Now, that still leaves the central third party with some important roles. The first role is, are you a valid member of the community that is involved around the ledger, and are the entries in the ledger things of importance? Did we actually award a degree to that individual? Is that truly a ship on the shipping register or just a fictitious entry? So they still have an important role, but they're unable to abuse that role as much as they have in the past. We've certainly seen many cases over the years in the financial markets where central points of failure have come in a ledger form. One need only think of the London Interbank Offer Rate scandal, the LIBOR scandal, which persisted for 7 years because there was a central third party keeping a ledger there that was being fudged. We've had similar issues in the foreign exchange markets and other things. That's just here in London. But when you look at central third parties, they do have an opportunity to cheat, and this reduces that opportunity to cheat. And it also means if they're not cheating, but they're overcharging, my switching costs are lower. I can go to them and say, well, actually, I have all of that data, and I would like to take from you the power to write the authority onto the ledger. I'd like to give that to somebody else because I'm afraid, you know, you've been charging us too much. Now, that may sound very negative. Actually, I think it's enormously positive because central third parties, if we can have more of them in society, we can build more trust, we can do more transactions more securely using this technology.
Michael, in your point of view, what will blockchain augment, change, or replace?
In my point of view, the mutual distributed ledgers have the opportunity to augment the current central third party position. So they'll allow us to use central third parties more securely and safely. This does mean that anybody who's operating as a central third party needs to consider their role carefully. That doesn't mean disruption necessarily, or massive disruption or displacement, but it does mean they need to think about it. So when you look for central third parties, you might look at Visa or MasterCard. You might look at SWIFT for international payments. You might look at a stock exchange. Anybody who's operating where they're helping people to undertake exchanges and controlling a ledger will need to think very carefully about how much money are they making out of the information in that ledger. Are they effectively selling back the data to their own clients? And if they're doing so, selling back data, effectively the client's data to their own clients, it's going to be a little bit more difficult to do that. If they're in some way feeling that they're in an invulnerable position because it's going to be difficult to move from them to another third party at the center, they ought to be thinking about that as well. We were approached in 2015 by some U.S. insurers who wanted to look at how distributed ledgers might transform the way that they provide insurance in the electricity markets. So in the current electricity markets, we've been talking for ages about differential electricity contracts or contracts where you pay a lower rate if you allow the utility to turn your appliances on or off. Now, in that type of a situation, liability becomes quite an issue. So these U.S. insurers have been approached by some U.S. utilities who are asking about how the insurance for this would be handled. And the hypothetical case is that Henrik comes home on a hot day in D.C. He goes to his freezer. He opens his freezer up, and it's full of mush. Well, he knows that his home and contents policy will pay for some of this, so he rings up his insurer, and his insurer says, well, yeah, that's nice, Henrik, but I'm not paying $2,000 for your freezer contents because I see you've got one of these newfangled electricity contracts. So it must have been the electricity company that turned it off. So you ring the electricity company, and they say, well, yeah, we do have control of your freezer, but we didn't do that. It's probably badly installed. So you ring your freezer installer, and they say, nope, it's working fine. But where do you turn at this point? Is your lawyer going to write a really stiff note to the electricity company saying, please provide me millisecond by millisecond with the on-off switching that goes on in your network? Mm-hmm. Are you going to write the same thing to your freezer manufacturer? It's not easy. Because what we're going to need is obviously some type of ledger facility that gives us an authoritative look on what happened millisecond by millisecond. And it is true in the United States that this is a bit of a line item because you might have unplugged to vacuum that morning and forgotten to put it back in, and therefore that's why it's gone to mush. Or it does happen that people get to the end of the month and don't have enough ready cash and they want to turn frozen food into liquid assets. So these are the sorts of things that happen in real life, and I'd like to see a ledger that says, here's what happened, and to automate that payment away, because we're certainly not going to be doing it with vast armies of paralegals poring over electricity and utility bills. Now, that's just one small example, but you now move that into, we've got home security systems that will be the same way. Who turned the alarm on or off just before the burglary occurred? You know, was it you? Was it an accident? Was it the burglar? Was it the security company doing some routine maintenance? What are we going to be doing about autonomous vehicles? I've got nine radars on my car. I'm talking to the road service. I'm talking to the road bed. I'm talking to the vehicles beside me. I'm talking to the National Weather Service or Meteorological Office. Mm-hmm. And then, bang, I hit something. Well, you know, to unravel all of that is going to require an authoritative ledger. So I see a future with, we've got 7 billion people supposedly rising to 10 or 11 billion people by the middle of the century. I could see, frankly, 10 billion people times 10 or 15 ledgers each, looking at all of those records and controlling it. And again, it may sound a bit auditor or accountancy, but in reality, auditing and accounting and trust has been what's made society function. And I think these ledgers are going to take us to a whole new level to allow us to automate a lot of that problem away.
And Michael, how will people make money with blockchain?
Oh, how will people make money with blockchain? I think mutual distributed ledgers are fundamentally a little bit different. The principal reason is that this isn't the dot-com boom. I know a lot of people are trying to phrase it that way, and certainly there are a couple of companies out there that have valuations that astonish me, if I can be frank. I've seen a few out there where we've got applications that already have been working, and they've raised $85 million or $140 million effectively to go out and rebuild the same thing, which is fine. That's just life. But where I see people making money is actually by helping other people. This is where I would emphasize mutual and mutual distributed ledgers. Because these are multi-organizational databases, you've got to go and look at places where multiple organizations have hitherto had difficulties working with each other. And there's quite a few very obvious good examples. In the shipping industry, there's been a lot of reticence about setting up a central exchange that has too much power. Again, this mutual distributed ledgers keep that power structure from getting out of control. And so there are whole piles of documents and systems called, for example, Bolero or S-Docs, where this could move now onto the ledger and automate a lot of the very, very manual processes that you find in shipping. Another good example is in insurance. There's a set of XML standards called Accord in the insurance sector. And again, these move quite naturally into mutual distributed ledgers. So anywhere where there's a large number of organizations that need to work together and fear creating a central third party that would extract exorbitant rents from a natural monopoly, they can now use this technology with some safety. So I would say to people who want to make money out of blockchain, don't worry about the money. Worry about what you're doing to help groups of people work together. You may not make a mega fortune, because I don't see this as the mega fortune of the dot-com, but you'll make a good living. People always reward people who help other people work better together.
Michael, what advice do you have for those interested in blockchain?
I think the principal advice for those interested in blockchain is probably twofold. One, be aware that this is actually a fairly straightforward technology. It's the hashing of records from before into records that are being currently written out. So it's the history of a series of transactions being recorded in a way that they're indelible. There are some tricky bits to it, both in the maths and in how the ledger itself is distributed. And then finally, new transactions are being written to the ledger, validated, and there are a plethora of ways of doing that. But I think I would encourage people, honestly, to go on a programming course, even if it's a programming course for a week or two, just so that you're not talking about things that you don't really understand. I think the second thing is, having understood that this is a comprehensible technology, it's not magic. This isn't as deep as many of the pieces of technology that go into areas like biotech or material science or quantum mechanics. It's fairly straightforward stuff. Now I think you can turn with a solid base of understanding of the programming behind it to thinking very, very hard about where is it that people need to work together. And I would encourage them then to really understand multi-organizational business processes. And the combination of those two things, multi-organizational business processes, and an understanding of the types of multi-organizational databases that these ledgers provide should be sufficient for those who are interested in distributed ledgers to make some of the money that they dream of.
Great. Well, thanks, Michael.
For more on this, visit blockchainbillionspodcast.com. Be sure to subscribe, rate, and review. And for a book about this, check out blockchainbillionsbook.com. Thanks for listening.